pyramids and megalithic temples, and on that single-syllable calf, which was once present on the 18th Dynasty Dream Stela. The flimsy case of Egyptology. As to context, even if the pyramids were exclusively the work of the 4th Dynasty, which is called into question, as we've seen, by the surface luminescence dating of the pyramid attributed to Menkaure, we could still not safely deduce that the Sphinx is also 4th Dynasty work. Indeed, it could be the case that the pyramids were built where they are precisely because the Sphinx was already there, bestowing an air of ancient sanctity on the site. Neither do the megalithic temples really prove anything about the Sphinx, since there is no evidence that unequivocally dates their own construction to the 4th Dynasty. The most that can be said is that a black diorite statue of Khafre, now in the Cairo Museum, was found dumped upside down in a deep pit in the Valley Temple. However, this tells us only that Khafre at some point required his statue to be placed in the temple, and that he therefore identified with the temple in some way, not that he built it. Superficially more persuasive is the claim made by some Egyptologists that Khafre's name was found inscribed at the Valley Temple. On his Guardian's website, National Geographic Explorer in Residence Dr. Zahi Hawass, the former director of the Giza Plateau and Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities, has this to say about the Valley Temple. Inscriptions in the building are around the entrance doorways. They list the king's names and titles, those of the goddess Bastet, north doorway, and those of Hathor, south doorway. Wikipedia, which is influential in shaping public perceptions of Giza, and which routinely labels non-mainstream approaches as pseudoscience, goes even further than Hawass when it says of the Valley Temple that blocks have been found showing the partial remains of an inscription with the Horus name of Khafre, Weser Ib. On closer examination, however, Wikipedia turns out to be misinformed. Stephen Quirk, professor of Egyptian archaeology at University College London, was kind enough to look into this for me when I raised it with him, and in due course reported the results of his investigation. The partial inscription with the Horus name of Khafre does not, in fact, appear on blocks from the Valley Temple, but rather on blocks from an entirely different building at Giza. What then of Dr. Hawass's statement about the king's names and titles? It is clear, at any rate, what his source is, because in the first 1947 edition of his classic study, The Pyramids of Egypt, I.E.S. Edwards, formerly keeper of Egyptian antiquities at the British Museum, wrote several pages about the Valley Temple, which, along with the rest of the Egyptological profession by this time, he identified as being the work of Khafre. Around each doorway, he stated, is a band of hieroglyphic inscription giving the name and titles of the king. No other inscriptions or reliefs occur anywhere else in the building. That would seem to settle the matter were it not for the fact that many years later, when Edwards produced the definitive final edition of his book, he revised the above passage with important information that he did not present in 1947. Around each doorway, we now read, was carved a band of hieroglyphic inscriptions, giving the name and titles of the king. But only the last words, beloved of Bastet and beloved of Hathor, are preserved. No other inscriptions occur anywhere else in the building. Needless to say, the words beloved of Bastet and beloved of Hathor do not in isolation like this prove that Khafre was the king referred to as being the beloved of these deities. They could apply to anybody and therefore cannot legitimately be used to support the claim that the Valley Temple was the work of Khafre. Is there anything else to support that claim? The obscure and eye-wateringly expensive Encyclopedia of the Archaeology of Ancient Egypt contains an entry on the Khafre Pyramid Complex. Written again by Zahi Hawass, the entry informs us that the Valley Temple is identified with Khafre from inscriptions on granite casing blocks from the western end of the Valley Temple. Reliefs from this complex were discovered at El Lisht, where they were used as fill for the pyramid of Amenemhat I, 12th Dynasty. Now this is really clutching at straws, since they are miles away at El Lisht, cannibalized as filler material for a later monarch's pyramid. The reality is that these blocks tell us nothing reliable at all about the Valley Temple. Perhaps they were taken from there, but then again, perhaps they came from somewhere else entirely. Besides, nobody is claiming that any of the inscriptions were made on the limestone core masonry of the Valley Temple. All of them appear on granite casing blocks, and as we've seen, the granite casing blocks of the Valley Temple give every appearance of being a veneer that was applied long after the core limestone blocks were set in place. In some cases, perhaps as early as 3640 BC, and in others, perhaps as late as 1190 BC. That Khafre may well have been one of several pharaohs who carried out restoration work on the Valley Temple during this long period, and that he commemorated his good deeds with an official inscription and some statues of himself, perhaps at the same time as he also appears to have carried out a restoration project on the Sphinx, does not mean that he was the original builder, either of the Sphinx or the temple. So we are left then with that single syllable Khaf on the 18th Dynasty dream stela, which modern Egyptologists, unlike their 19th century predecessors, have eagerly grasped as proof that Khafre built the Sphinx. Needless to say, the 18th Dynasty and the 4th Dynasty are not contemporary with one another. Moreover, there is a strong case to be made that even the 18th Dynasty attribution of the stela is questionable. Breasted, for example, points to errors and striking irregularities in orthography, and to a number of other suspicious peculiarities, leading him to conclude that the inscription was not in fact the work of Thutmosis IV, but was a late restoration, dating to between the 21st dynasty and the 26th Saitic dynasty. In other words, it is quite possible that the dream stela is as young as the inventory stela. Yet Egyptologic requires the shaky evidence of the Khaf syllable on the former to be accepted as proof that Khafre made the Sphinx, whereas the several clear statements on the latter that absolutely contradict the attribution to Khafre are rejected as preposterous fictions. Dynamite revelations. Here are some extracts from the text of the inventory stela. Note before reading that all the pharaohs of Egypt were regarded as incarnations of the god Horus, and the name Horus was therefore routinely included in their titles. Each king also had a Horus name, which in Khufu's case was Mezer. Live, Horus the Mezer, the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Khufu, given life. He found the house of Isis, mistress of the pyramid, by the side of the cavity of the Sphinx, on the northwest of the house of Osiris, lord of Rostau. The plans of the image of Horemachet were brought in order to bring to revision the sayings of the disposition of the image. He restored the statue, all covered in painting. He made to quarry the hind part of the Nemes headdress, which was lacking, from gilded stone, and which had a length of about 7 ells, 3.7 meters. He came to make a tour in order to see the thunderbolt, which stands in the place of the sycamore, so named because of a great sycamore, whose branches were struck when the Lord of Heaven descended upon the place of Horemachet. The figure of this god, being cut in stone, is solid and will exist to eternity, having always its face regarding the east. The language of the inventory stela is obscure, but Salim Hassan's analysis brings some clarity. If we could believe its inscriptions, he writes, we should have to credit Khufu with having repaired the Sphinx, apparently after it had been damaged by a thunderbolt. As a matter of fact, there may be a grain of truth in this story, for the tale of the Nemes headdress of the Sphinx is certainly missing, and it is not a part which, by reason of its shape and position, could easily be broken off except by a direct blow from some heavy object, delivered with terrific force. There is actually to be seen on the back of the Sphinx the scar of this breakage, and traces of the old mortar with which it was repaired. This scar measures about 4 meters, which accords with the measurements recorded on the stela. Therefore, it is perhaps likely that the Sphinx was struck by lightning, but there is not a particle of evidence to show that this accident happened in the reign of Khufu. Neither, however, is there any evidence to prove that the accident to the Sphinx did not happen in the reign of Khufu. All we have is the Egyptological bias that it could not have happened then, because the Sphinx is supposed to be the work of Khafre, undertaken after Khufu's death, and therefore obviously should not have existed in Khufu's time. The same goes for the second dynamite revelation of the inventory stela, namely the mention of the House of Osiris, Lord of Rostau. We can gather the location of this structure because the cavity of the Sphinx is said to lie on its northwest, which means, to put things the other way round, that the House of Osiris, Lord of Rostau, is located immediately southeast of the Sphinx. The only structure which fits these coordinates is the Vali Temple, which does indeed lie immediately southeast of the Sphinx. As with the references to the Sphinx itself, therefore, the testimony of the inventory stela is that the Vali Temple was not made by Khafre, since it was already in existence in the time of his predecessor Khufu. These, then, are the real reasons why the inventory stela has been rejected by Egyptologists as a preposterous fiction, rather say than as an inscription that preserves and transmits to a later age, using language and terminology suitable to that age, a much older but genuine tradition. Certainly, the rejection cannot be because the inventory stela is not contemporary with the reign of Khufu, or because of its 26th dynasty orthography, since such factors do not prevent Egyptologists from accepting the dream stela, which suffers from the same non-contemporaneity and the same striking irregularities in orthography. In short, is it not obvious that the inventory stela has been rejected and ignored, while the dream stela has been accepted and embraced, because the former blows the established theory of Egyptian history completely out of the water, while the latter can be conveniently spun to support the established theory? A Bolt from Heaven and an Ancient Archive. Quite apart from its implications of a much older Sphinx, there are two other aspects of the inventory stela that merit further investigation. The first is the information that the Sphinx had been damaged by a thunderbolt. Salim Hassan is willing to accept there might be some truth to that, but we cannot be sure that a thunderbolt means a lightning strike as he assumes. The thunderbolt in question is said in the inscription still to have been present for Khufu to see when he made his tour. This would not be the case with lightning, which would leave damage but not a physical object that could be viewed. On the other hand, a meteorite, after striking and damaging the Sphinx, would have been there, on the spot, for inspection by the king, and descending in fire from the sky, amidst awesome noise, burning a great old tree in its passage, a meteorite might easily be described as a thunderbolt. Indeed, in a number of cultures, that was exactly how meteorites were described. Equally intriguing is the inventory stela's statement that the plans of the image of Horemachet, i.e. of the Sphinx, were brought to the site by Khufu, presumably for reference purposes while the repair of the monument was undertaken. This very obviously implies the existence of an ancient archive pertaining to Giza, perhaps a hall of records, reminiscent of the lost records in the temple library at Edfu from which we know the building texts were extracted. These, as we've seen, were said to be the words of the seven sages, taken down in writing by no less a personage than the wisdom god Thoth himself. Raymond even suggests that there may once have existed a sacred book of the early primeval age of the gods, in which the whole divine plan in Egypt was set out. And the indications are, she says, that this was linked to a second ancient book, the specification of the mounds of the early primeval age, which was believed to contain records not only of all the lesser mounds and the temples that would ultimately be built upon them as part of the project to bring about the rebirth of the destroyed world of the gods, but also of the great primeval mound itself. Unfortunately, nothing more is known about either of these lost books than the few very brief and tantalizing references to them at Edfu. Nonetheless, as I suggested earlier, There is every possibility that this great primeval mound, where the time of the present age of the earth supposedly began, was the rocky hill at Giza, around which the Great Pyramid would in due course be built. There is, too, an extraordinary text, preserved on papyrus from Egypt's Middle Kingdom, which speaks of a search for the secret chambers of the Sanctuary of Thoth, secret chambers that Khufu wished to copy for his temple. A deep and ancient mystery that we'll explore in the next chapter lies concealed in these strange references. Chapter 11. The Books of Thoth. A quick summary. The Edfu building texts speak of the homeland of the primeval ones, an island, the location of which is never specified, that was destroyed by an enemy described as a serpent, the great leaping one. The serpent's assault caused a flood that inundated this primeval world of the gods, killing the majority of its divine inhabitants. A few of them, however, escaped the disaster and fled the scene in boats to wander the earth. Their purpose in so doing was to identify suitable sites where they might set in motion a sacred design to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods, the recreation of a destroyed world. All of these events took place in the early primeval age, a very, very long time ago, so long ago that they would have passed beyond human remembering if great efforts had not been made to preserve them. In our temples, the Egyptian priests of Sais reportedly told Solon, "We have preserved, from earliest times, a written record of any great or splendid achievement or notable event which has come to our ears." This was the case, too, at Edfu, where Raymond's detailed study reveals that a vast and extensive archive once existed, from which the extracts were taken that the priests carved into the temple walls, and that thus still survive. It is by following the trail of clues in these extracts, as we did in the last chapter, that we've arrived at the Great Sphinx, perhaps the very lion which had the face of a man, that Horus was said in the Edfu texts to have transformed himself into. In this context, the reference in the inventory stela to Khufu having access to plans of the Sphinx, which he refers to when he restores the statue, is suggestive of the existence of an ancient archive of Giza, perhaps an archive dating back to the remote age when the site was founded by the gods, with distinctive astronomical characteristics that would later allow the whole complex to be described as a book which descended from the sky. Does this book refer to the constellation of Leo as it appeared at dawn on the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, a constellation that descended from the sky at Giza in the form of the Great Sphinx? And did the three belt stars of the constellation of Orion, as they looked in that distant epoch, descend from the sky at Giza in the form of the ground plans of the three great pyramids? We've seen that the Sphinx, or at any rate large parts of it, could very well have been carved in the epoch of 10,500 BC. The pyramids were certainly completed much later, but it's my belief that they were built over pre-existing structures dating back to the time of the gods, gods whom the Edfu texts tell us quite explicitly were capable of uniting with the sky. These pre-existing structures would, of course, have been hidden when they were replaced by the pyramids. Amongst them the original natural hill that anchors the whole plan, and which was later incorporated into the structure of the Great Pyramid. Since the Edfu texts envisage the work of the gods as the recreation in other lands of their lost world, and since the key feature of that lost homeland was a primeval temple that was erected on a low mound, it becomes all the more likely they would have sought to reproduce these features at Giza. At any rate, no lesser authority than Professor I.E.S. Edwards, formerly Keeper of Egyptian Antiquities at the British Museum, was of the view that the natural hill, now incorporated within the Great Pyramid, was indeed the great primeval mound that is referred to so often in ancient Egyptian texts, a mound, we now understand, that drew its sanctity from its predecessor, that had once stood in the lost world of the gods. That mound, Raymond tells us, formed the original nucleus of the world of the gods in the primeval age, so it follows that the rocky mound at the heart of the Great Pyramid, and later the Great Pyramid itself, served the same function in the project to resurrect that lost world in Egypt. The Inventory Stela is by no means the only testimony to the existence of ancient plans connected with that project. We've seen in the Edfu texts how these plans were part of an archive, believed to have been set down in writing by the wisdom god Thoth, according to the words of the sages. So it is not surprising that the ancient Egyptians of later times became obsessed with the books of Thoth, which they appear to have lost access to, and which came to be regarded as the fount of all knowledge. A number of papyri have survived documenting searches for the books of Thoth, and these searches, not surprisingly, are always said to have taken place in the vicinity of Giza and the Memphite necropolis. There is, for example, the story of Setnau Khemaust, a son of Ramesses II, one of the great pharaohs of the 13th century BC, informed that a book written by Thoth himself lay concealed in an ancient tomb near Giza. Setnau went there with his brother and passed 3 days and nights seeking for the tomb. And on the third day they found it and went down to the place where the book was. When the two brothers came into the tomb, they found it to be brilliantly lit by the light which came forth from the book. There seems to be a hint of an ancient technology here, reminiscent of Yima's underground Vara, which glowed with its own light, or of the mysterious illumination of Noah's Ark, described in Chapter 7. What sound like the artifices of a lost technology are also mentioned in Arab traditions concerning Giza. The Egyptian historian Ibn Abd al-Hakim believed that the pyramids were built as places of safekeeping for antediluvian knowledge, prominently including archives of books containing the profound sciences and the names of drugs and their uses and hurts, and the science of astrology and arithmetic and geometry and medicine and everything that is and shall be from the beginning to the end of time. Hakim, who lived in the 9th century AD, could have known nothing of advanced metallurgy or plastics, yet he stated that amongst the treasures from the time before the flood that were hidden away in the bowels of the pyramids were arms which did not rust and glass which might be bent but not broken. He likewise described machines that guarded these antediluvian remnants, including an idol of black agate, sitting upon a throne with a lance. His eyes were open and shining. When anyone looked upon him, he heard on one side of him a voice which took away his sense, so that he fell prostrate upon his face and did not cease until he died. A second machine also took the form of a statue. He who looked towards it was drawn by the statue until he stuck to it, and could not be separated from it until such time as he died. Returning to the traditions of the ancient Egyptians themselves, we have a text from the Westcar Papyrus, which dates to the Middle Kingdom around 1650 BC, but was copied from an older document now lost. The text makes reference to a building called Inventory, located in the sacred city that the ancient Egyptians knew as Innu, that the Bible calls On, and that the Greeks later made famous under the name Heliopolis, the city of the sun, 11 miles northeast of Giza. According to the papyrus, a chest of flint was stored in Heliopolis, containing a mysterious document that Pharaoh Khufu himself is reported to have spent much time searching for, a document that recorded the number of the secret chambers of the sanctuary of Thoth, which Khufu wished to copy for his temple. What are we dealing with here? I.E.S. Edwards points out that Heliopolis, the site of the inventory building, had been a center for astronomical science, closely connected to Giza since time immemorial, and that the title of the high priest of that city was Chief of the Astronomers. To this, the Egyptologist F.W. Green adds that the inventory building appears to have been a chart room at Heliopolis, or perhaps a drawing room, where plans were made and stored. Similarly, Sir Alan H. Gardner argues that the room in question must have been an archive, and that Khufu was seeking for details concerning the secret chambers of the primeval sanctuary of Thoth. So once again, we're confronted by a report that Khufu sought out and consulted ancient documents to guide his works at Giza, whether to restore the Sphinx to its original appearance, as we are told in the inventory stela, or to build his temple in the correct way, incorporating an ancient design, as the Westcar papyrus suggests. Such traditions, in my view, further strengthen the notion that whatever Khufu and the other pharaohs of the Fourth Dynasty were doing at Giza was more of the order of the fulfillment and completion of plans they had inherited from the time of the gods, antediluvian plans, in other words, than the implementation of some novel scheme of their own. They were, in short, playing their part in the resurrection of the former world of the gods. Moreover, the surface luminescence dating results reported in Chapter 10, when taken together with the geological arguments about the age of the Sphinx and its temples, invite us to consider that this process had originated in the flood epoch of 10,500 BC, had then lain practically dormant for many millennia, during which the ancient knowledge and archives were maintained by initiates in something like a monastery, and then got underway again, perhaps as early as the 4th millennium BC, with a gradual build-up to its completion and fulfillment in the epoch of 2500 BC. The existence of such a college of initiates is signaled clearly in the Edfu texts, which speak of the long-term mission of the builder gods, who fashioned, in the primeval time, the lords of the light, the ghosts, the ancestors, who raised the seed for gods and men, the senior ones who came into being at the beginning, who illumined this land when they came forth unitedly. The Edfu texts do not claim that these beings were immortal. After their deaths, we're told, the next generation came to their graves to perform the funerary rites on their behalf and then took their places. In this way, through an unbroken chain of initiation and transmission of knowledge, the builder gods, the sages, the ghosts, the lords of the light, the shining ones described in the Edfu texts, were able to renew themselves constantly like the mythical phoenix, thus passing down to the future traditions and wisdoms stemming from a previous epoch of the earth. Another name for these initiates, and an appropriate one, given the importance of Horus at Edfu, was the Shemsu Hor, the followers of Horus. Under this name, they were particularly closely associated with Heliopolis, the sacred city where the records of the secret chambers of the sanctuary of Thoth were kept. The reader will recall that at Edfu, it was the seven sages who specified the plans and designs that were to be used for all future temples throughout the length and breadth of Egypt. So it is interesting that at Dendera, a little to the north of Edfu, inscriptions tell us that the great plan used by its architects were recorded in ancient writings handed down from the followers of Horus, identical in all respects to the sages and the builder gods. These followers of Horus were said to have carried with them a knowledge of the divine origins of Egypt, and of the divine purpose of this land, which once was holy and wherein alone, in reward for her devotion, the gods deigned to sojourn upon earth. Stones fallen from heaven. The nexus, interlinking the sages of the Edfu texts with Giza, Heliopolis, and the followers of Horus, offers a number of clues that will enable us to take this inquiry forward. Amongst these, of the first importance, is the fact that Heliopolis, an uninteresting suburb of Cairo today, was once the site of the Temple of the Phoenix, known in ancient Egypt as the Bennu bird, that famous symbol of resurrection and rebirth. In this temple, often referred to as the Mansion of the Phoenix, was kept a mysterious object, long since lost to history, a stone called the Benben, a word closely linked etymologically to Bennu, said to have fallen from heaven and depicted as the seed, the sperm, of Ra Atum, the father of the gods. In the ancient Egyptian language, the determinative of the word benben, as one expert explains, shows a tapering, somewhat conical shape for the benben stone, which became stylized for use in architecture as a small pyramid, the pyramidion. Covered in gold foil, it was held aloft by the long shaft of the obelisk and shone in the rays of the sun, whom the obelisks glorified. Likewise, the capstone of every pyramid was also referred to as its benben. An example in excellent condition has survived from the pyramid of the 12th dynasty pharaoh Amenemhat III and can be seen in the Cairo Museum. Numerous theories have been put forward as to where the concept of the benben came from, but the most compelling in my view is the work of my friend and colleague Robert Boval that first appeared in the scholarly journal Discussions in Egyptology in 1989 under the title Investigation on the Origins of the Benben Stone. Was it an iron meteorite? Similar to many other cases of the worship of meteorites by ancient peoples, Robert argued, it is likely that the Benben stone, once worshipped in the Mansion of the Phoenix, was a meteorite. Its conical shape is very suggestive of an oriented iron meteorite, possibly a mass within the 1 to 15 ton range. Such objects, fallen from heaven, were generally representative of fallen stars and likely provided the Egyptian clergy with a tangible star object, a seed of Ra Atum. A linked possibility was considered by the Egyptologist R. T. Rundle Clark in 1949 in a paper entitled The Origin of the Phoenix for the University of Birmingham Historical Journal. He drew attention to the earliest surviving mention of the Bennu bird, which is found in the pyramid texts, Old Kingdom, 5th and 6th dynasties, and reads as follows. Thou, the god Ra Atum is addressed, did shine upon the Benben stone, in the house of the Bennu bird in Heliopolis. But curiously, the Benben stone, always shown in later texts as a geometrical pyramidion, is depicted in the pyramid texts as a rough stone with slightly curved sides. This is an important fact, observed Rundle Clark, since it shows that the pyramids were not exact copies of the original Benben stone in Heliopolis. One can assume that the Benben stone became a pyramidion during the old empire, but whether influenced by the actual developed contour of the 4th dynasty pyramids cannot be determined. He went on to note something else that caught my attention. The form of the Benben stone in the pyramid texts is that of an omphalos or betel, the umbilical stone which is so widespread in the early religion of Asia. It is the lesson of this text that the Benben stone is a betel-like object and that it is modified into a pyramidion by the 4th dynasty. What Rundle Clark did not appear to realize in his 1949 paper, and that strongly reinforces Robert Boval's later argument, is that betels, wherever they were worshipped, were nothing more nor less than meteorites, although often they were stony rather than iron meteorites. I had occasion to investigate this issue in some depth in the 1980s when I was researching my book The Sign and the Seal, with specific reference to the two tablets of the Ten Commandments said to be contained within the Ark of the Covenant. Biblical scholar Menachem Haran, author of the authoritative Temples and Temple Service in Ancient Israel, argues persuasively that the Ark held not two tables of the law, but a meteorite from Mount Sinai. As such, the ancient worship of the Ark and its contents fits in with a wider tradition distributed across the whole of the Near and Middle East of veneration of stones that fell from heaven. An example that has survived into the modern world is the special reverence accorded by Muslims to the sacred black stone built into the corner of the wall of the Kaaba in Mecca. Touched by every pilgrim making the Hajj to the holy site, this stone was declared by the Prophet Muhammad to have fallen from heaven to earth, where it was first given to Adam to absorb his sins after his expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Later it was presented by the angel Gabriel to Abraham, the Hebrew patriarch. Finally it became the cornerstone of the Kaaba, the beating heart of the Islamic world. Geologists attribute a meteoric origin to the black stone. Likewise, the betels, sacred stones, that some pre-Islamic Arab tribes carried on their desert wanderings were meteorites. and a direct line of cultural transmission is recognized linking these Baitals, which were often placed in portable shrines, with the black stone of the Kaaba and with the stone tablets of the law contained within the Ark. In Europe, Baitals were also known and were called Lapis Betilis, a name stemming from Semitic origins and taken over at a late date by the Greeks and Romans for sacred stones that were assumed to possess a divine life, stones with a soul that were used for diverse superstitions, for magic and for fortune-telling. They were meteoric stones fallen from the sky. With all this in mind, the special interest of Khufu in the thunderbolt mentioned in the inventory stela takes on a new significance. As the reader will recall, the inscription speaks of the Lord of Heaven, an epithet for Ra Atum, descending on the Sphinx and inflicting the damage that Khufu would later repair according to the ancient plans to which he had access. For such a thunderbolt to be merely a lightning strike, as Salim Hassan suggests, makes no sense, since the inventory stela tells us very clearly that Khufu visited the site in order to see the thunderbolt. In short, an object that had fallen from the sky and that could reasonably be described as the result of the Lord of Heaven descending on the Sphinx must still have been physically present there. A meteorite satisfies this context, but it could not, of course, have been the Benben kept at Heliopolis, for the mansion of the Phoenix and the Benben already existed in Khufu's time. The pharaoh's eagerness to see the thunderbolt does, however, testify to the special reverence that was accorded to this class of objects, and it is natural to wonder what specific event that reverence goes back to, and how far it goes back. Could it, for example, go back all the way to the time memorialized in the Edfu texts? The time when the island of the gods was destroyed in the cataclysmic flood caused by the assault of the enemy serpent, so evocatively described as the Great Leaping One. Before attempting to answer that question, let's consider the Benben stone and the Bennu bird with which it is associated a little more closely. The Flight of the Phoenix. R.T. Rundle Clark, who made an in-depth study of the Bennu Phoenix, reports that the ancient Egyptians believed in a vital essence, Haik, that had been brought to their land from a distant, magical source. The latter was the Isle of Fire, the place of everlasting light, beyond the limits of the world, where the gods were born or revived and whence they were sent into the world. The Phoenix is the chief messenger from this inaccessible land of divinity. A coffin text makes the victorious soul say, "I came from the Isle of Fire, having filled my body with Haik, like that bird who came and filled the world with that which it had not known." So the Phoenix came from far away, Rundle Clark concludes, bringing the message of light and life to a world wrapped in the helplessness of primeval night. Its flight is the width of the world, over oceans, seas, and rivers, to land at last in Heliopolis, the symbolic center of the earth, where it will announce a new age. There is much in this summary that is evocative of the Edfu texts, the far-off island from which the gods are sent out, the return of the light after an episode of primeval darkness, and an arrival at Heliopolis, where a new age is set in motion. Indeed, the Phoenix might almost be said to symbolize the mission of those gods, who fled their drowned homeland with a long-term plan to bring about the rebirth and renewal of the former world. But the symbolic crossovers go deeper than this and become more complex. The Phoenix, remember, is closely associated not just with light, but also with fire. Thus Lactantius, writing in the 4th century AD, tells us that the Phoenix bathes in holy waters and feeds on living spray. After 1,000 years, it builds a nest as a sepulchre, supplied with various rich juices and odors. As it sits on the nest, its body grows hot enough to produce flames, which in turn burn the body to ashes, destined to produce a milky white worm. The latter falls asleep, and then forms into an egg, eventually to sprout forth as a bird from the broken shell. After taking nourishment, it rolls the ashes into a ball enclosed in myrrh and frankincense, which the newborn bird transports to an altar in the city of Heliopolis. This theme of fire and of regeneration and new life emerging from a fiery death also crops up in ancient Iran, where Yima built his Vara, and where the phoenix was called the Simorgh. As folklorist E.V.A. Keneally explains, the accounts of the Simorgh decisively establish that the death and revival of the phoenix exhibit the successive destruction and reproduction of the world, which many believe to be affected by the agency of a fiery deluge. Different lengthy periods, 1,000 years, 500 years, 540 years, 7,006 years, are given for the life of the phoenix before it dies in fire and then renews itself. There is, however, a strong and very specific tradition relayed, for example, by Solinus in the early 3rd century AD, which sets the period of the phoenix at what seems to be a completely arbitrary and bizarre number, 12,954 years. But further investigation reveals that the period of the phoenix's return was thought to correspond to the great year. And the great year, we already know, is an ancient concept linked to the precession of the equinoxes with its 12 great months, one for the sun's passage through each house of the zodiac of 2,160 years each. Thus 12 times 2,160 equals 25,920 years. That figure of 25,920 years is in turn, of course, very close to twice 12,954 years. 2 times 12,954 equals 25,908 years. Too close to be a coincidence, in my opinion. Especially when we remember that Cicero, in his Hortensius, specifically linked the great year to the number 12,954. The figure of 540 years given in other sources for the period of the phoenix also turns out to be derived from the great year, as Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschend demonstrated in Hamlet's Mill, their masterly study of precessional knowledge transmitted through myth. As we saw in Chapter 10, the heartbeat of the precessional cycle is the number 72, the number of years required for 1 degree of precession. We then add 36, half of 72, to the number 72 to get 108. Next, we half 108 to get 54, and finally multiply 54 by 10 to get 540. I went into all this in great detail in Fingerprints of the Gods 20 years ago. And refer the reader to that book for a full exposition of these precessional numbers, which are found in ancient myths and traditions from all around the world, and which Santillana and von Deschend long ago demonstrated are proof of advanced astronomical knowledge in the deepest antiquity, knowledge that they attributed to some as yet unidentified and almost unbelievable ancestor civilization. What is particularly intriguing is how often ancient authorities connect the passage of the Great Year, which we now see to be linked to the period of the Phoenix, to a world conflagration and a world flood, not necessarily as the cause of those cataclysms, but as a timer that records and predicts them. Confronted by such material, despite all the oddities and contradictions it has been weighed down with during the passage of several millennia, I am forcibly reminded of the Younger Dryas comet and the conflagration and global flood that it brought in its wake, the latter caused by the catastrophic collapse of large segments of the North American and Northern European ice caps as they were hit by multiple large fragments, the former caused by superheated ejecta setting off forest fires across the minimum 50 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface that were directly affected. What goes around, comes around. Suppose you wished to pass a message to the future. And not just the near future, but the very distant future. You would be unwise to entrust it to writing, because you could not be certain that any civilization, 12,000 years from now, would be able to decipher your script. Besides, Even if the script could be deciphered, the written document on which you had placed your message might not survive the ravages of time. If you were really determined to be understood by some distant future generation, you might therefore do better to devise your message using gigantic architectural monuments that time itself would fear, monuments like the pyramids and the Great Sphinx of Giza, and to associate those monuments with a universal language, such as the slow precessional changes in the sky, that any astronomically literate culture would be able to read. Ideally also, your message should be a simple one. We saw in Chapter 10 how the Giza, Heliopolis, Memphis area perfectly fits the bill as one of the new sacred domains that the Edfu texts tell us were established at various locations by the wandering companies of gods seeking to bring about the resurrection of the former world destroyed in the flood. It is, moreover, a domain that fully justifies the description of a book descended from the sky. And when we read that book, written in the script of precession with the pen of megalithic architecture, it compels us to look at the epoch of 10,500 BC. Not an exact date, because the precessional clock gives indications that are too general to allow us to specify seconds or even minutes, but quite definitely to the epoch of 10,500 BC, in other words, about 12,500 years ago. The same general astronomical configurations that are symbolized on the ground by the great monuments of Giza would have held true for the best part of 500 years before 10,500 BC, and for about 1,000 years afterwards. In other words, as we've seen, the message of the monuments exactly encapsulates the cataclysmic episode of the Younger Dryas, which began suddenly and shockingly with the impacts of multiple fragments of a giant comet around 10,800 BC, in other words, around 12,800 years ago, and which ended equally suddenly, we do not yet know why, around 9,600 BC, in other words, around 11,600 years ago. The most likely explanation is that the Earth interacted again in 9,600 BC, with the debris stream of the same fragmenting comet that had caused the Younger Dryas to start in 10,800 BC. On the second occasion, however, the effects of the impacts were global warming rather than global cooling. With comets, as with the mythical phoenix, what goes around comes around. Since they are in orbit, they return to our skies at cyclic intervals. Some as short as 3.3 years, like Comet Encke, for example, some longer than 4,000 years, such as Comet Hale-Bopp, some even running into tens of thousands of years. Like the mythical phoenix also, comets do literally undergo a process of renewal, indeed rebirth, on each appearance in our skies. This is because comet nuclei are usually inert and utterly dark while traveling through deep space, producing no characteristic glowing coma and sparkling tail. However, as a comet approaches the Sun, and thus also the Earth, the solar rays cause volatile materials buried in its interior to burst into boiling, seething activity, producing jets of gas, scientists call the process outgassing, and shedding millions of tons of exceptionally fine dust and debris to form the coma and the tail. Last but not least, outgassing comets, like the Phoenix, do have the appearance of being consumed in flames. Moreover, the collision of large cometary fragments with the Earth itself, as the scientists studying the Younger Dryas impact event of 12,800 years ago have so graphically indicated, can be expected to result in conflagrations on a continent-wide scale, followed, if impacts occur on ice sheets, by global flooding. It is possible, indeed, highly probable, that we are not yet done with the comet that changed the face of the Earth between 10,800 BC and 9,600 BC. To be quite clear, as we will see in Chapter 19, some suspect that the return of the Phoenix will take place in our own time, indeed, by or before the year 2040, and there is a danger that one of the objects in its debris stream may be as much as 30 kilometers in diameter. A collision with such a large cometary fragment would, at the very least, mean the end of civilization as we know it, and perhaps even the end of all human life on this planet. Its consequences would be orders of magnitude more devastating than the Younger Dryas impacts 12,800 years ago that left us as a species with amnesia, obliged to begin again like children, with no memory of what went before. Or rather, with almost no memory, because in our beginning again, it seems we had the guidance, the leadership, the teachings, and the high wisdom of the sages, the shining ones, those magicians of the gods, who had survived from antediluvian times, and whose mission was to ensure that all was not, after all, lost. It doesn't make sense that they would have gone to such great lengths to spell out the epoch of 10,500 BC at Giza, just to say they were there. I suggest the science of their civilization was high enough for them to have understood exactly what had happened to the world, and to predict when it would happen again. I think, in short, that their purpose may have been to send us a message. We'll look more deeply into that message, and its implications, in later chapters. But first, there's another trail of clues to follow, a trail that may lead us closer to the magicians and their magic. Part 5. Stones. Chapter 12. Baalbek. We land at Beirut's International Airport in the late evening of the 9th of July, 2014. The airport is named after former Prime Minister Rafik Harari, who was assassinated on the 14th of February 2005 when his motorcade drove past a Mitsubishi van parked outside the St. George Hotel on the city's fashionable Mediterranean seafront, known as the Corniche. The van contained a young male suicide bomber, or so the very fragmentary DNA evidence suggests, and an estimated 1,800 kilos, about 4,000 pounds, of TNT. 23 people, amongst them Hariri, several of his bodyguards, and his close friend and former Minister of the Economy, Basel Flehan, were killed. Those suspected of organizing the massacre include senior members of Hezbollah, the Shia militant and political group that controls the town of Baalbek in the Bekaa Valley, where there are certain intriguing ancient ruins that I'm determined to see on this research visit to Lebanon. Hezbollah itself blames Israel. In addition, some suspect that President Bashar al-Assad of Syria was directly involved. The Syrian border runs along the eastern edge of the Bekaa Valley and very close to Baalbek itself, which was hit by missiles in June 2013, and where there are repeated violent incidents, with the horrendous Syrian civil war still in full swing, and huge numbers of refugees adding to the general state of chaos and instability. We've been advised to stay away. But I've wanted to see Baalbek for years, and I feel all the more strongly drawn to the ruins there after what I've learnt researching ancient Egypt. There are, you see, a number of puzzling connections, and I have these very much in mind, having been rereading my notes on the flight, as Santa and I step down out of the plane onto the tarmac and make our way into the terminal building. The night air is warm, but a refreshing breeze blows in off the Mediterranean, and I find myself looking forward to whatever adventures lie ahead. Our first encounter is with bureaucracy in the form of an immigration officer wearing a grey uniform over an open-necked shirt. He is young, but he has a sallow, unhealthy complexion and an unshaved, suspicious look about him. Indeed, he is extremely suspicious, as he makes clear each time he glances up from my passport to glare at me before returning to his forensic examination of the pages. My passport contains 41 pages with space for visas, and I travel frequently, so there are stamps from all over the world: Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, South Africa, India, the United States, Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Canada, Turkey. The young officer studies each stamp minutely, slowly leafing through the pages from front to back, glaring at me, returning to the investigation, glaring at me again. Then, when he has reached the very last page, he repeats the procedure, this time leafing through from back to front. I know what he's looking for: a visa stamp for Israel. the presence of which will allow him to deny me entry. He won't find one. Although my research has taken me to Israel several times, I'm always careful to get the entrance and exit stamps on a loose sheet of paper placed inside my passport rather than on the passport itself. Besides, my last visit was in 1999, and I've changed my passport twice since then, so there's nothing to be in the least bit concerned about. Even so, I have to admit I feel uncomfortable at this intense, sustained scrutiny. After going through the passport a third time, the officer gives me another hostile glare and asks, "Why you come to our country?" "Tourist," I reply. I know from long experience that saying anything about researching a book can lead to all manner of additional problems and suspicions that are best avoided. He raises a skeptical eyebrow. "Tourist?" "Yes, tourist. And you see what in our country?" I'm ready for the question. "Beirut, the beautiful Corniche. I've heard there are some great restaurants. Then we're going to Byblos, and of course to Baalbek." The eyebrow shoots up again. "Baalbek?" "Yes, of course. Wouldn't miss it for anything. This, at least, is true. The temples, the big stones, I've heard it's one of the wonders of the world." Suddenly a smile. "Wonderful, yes. I am from Baalbek, my hometown." He stamps my passport with a flourish and scrawls something in handwriting over the visa. "Welcome to Lebanon," he says. Now it's Santa's turn. But with the ice broken, the officer only flips through the pages of her passport once before stamping it and directing us onwards into the baggage hall. Well of Souls. On the drive in from the airport to our hotel, we pass the place where Rafik Hariri was assassinated. The damage was long ago cleared away, of course. Everything seems very chic, and despite the late hour, there are still a great many people, mostly young, mostly fashionably dressed, promenading along the Corniche, overlooking the glittering waters of the Mediterranean, in which the streetlights and the stars are pleasingly reflected. Amidst such a scene, it's hard to imagine the violence this city has witnessed during the past 40 years, and my thoughts turn again to the reasons we've come here. While I've been researching Egypt and the hints of an ancient civilizing mission after a global cataclysm described in the Edfu texts, I've found something odd that seems to suggest a possible link between the megalithic monuments of the Giza Plateau and Lebanon. A few thousand years ago, Lebanon formed the northern sector of the land the Bible refers to as Canaan, which also included the region covered roughly by modern Israel, the Palestinian territories, western Jordan, and southwestern Syria. What interests me is that both in Israel and in Lebanon, there are mysterious megalithic structures on a scale that not only rival those of Giza, but seem to express the same underlying purpose to create something that would last. Sacred mounds, holy places that would withstand the test of time and that would continue to be venerated down the ages even if the religions and cultures associated with them changed. The Temple Mount in Jerusalem is one such place. Both Orthodox archaeology and biblical testimony put the construction of the first great edifices there back to the almost mythical time of King Solomon, that renowned magician amongst monarchs who supposedly ruled in the 10th century BC. The structure known as Solomon's Temple, the first temple of the Jews, was destroyed by the Babylonians in 587 BC and rebuilt by Zerubbabel in the 520s BC. A further ambitious restoration was undertaken by the Romanized Jewish monarch Herod the Great in the 1st century BC and completed around 20 BC. Some 90 years after his death, Herod's temple in its turn was destroyed by the Romans, along with much of the city of Jerusalem, in 70 AD. What survived was the immense trapezoidal platform known today as the Haram es-Sharif, where stands the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, the third and fourth most sacred places in Islam. We need not concern ourselves here with the recent history of this place, or how it came to be in Muslim hands, but the Dome of the Rock is so called because within it lies an enormous megalith known to the Jews as the Shatiyah, literally the foundation. When the Temple of Solomon was erected over this exact spot in the 10th century BC, the Shetiyah formed the floor of the Holy of Holies, and the Ark of the Covenant, that enigmatic object which I have investigated extensively in another book, stood upon it. The Shetiyah is not the only megalith in Jerusalem that dates back potentially